This is the Pure Green Podcast, episode 16. This week, we have something new for you, an interview that centers around mindfulness and journeying back to your creative soul. We're talking with Susanna Conway, a thought leader who has helped thousands of women reconnect with who they are mainly through the use of journaling and photography. For Susanna, photography is a meditation, and she works to create images infused with soul that carry an imprint of her heart. This is what she teaches, and it's an effective tool to focus your attention on what's in front of you. Her practice gives a whole new meaning to the old adage of a picture is worth a thousand words. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast. Thanks for joining me for another episode of the podcast. I truly appreciate you sitting with me and listening and sharing in this space. It's really an awesome experience and I'm loving it so far. So I wanted to interview Susanna for a really long time as I followed her work and used some of her materials and I value them immeasurably. As I mentioned in the opener, this episode is a little different. Because I admire Susanna so much, I knew you'd enjoy listening to her as well. But it goes a little deeper than that. You may have noticed that our mantra at Pure Green is inspired conscious living. The conscious part being the key word, because we hope that we help inspire readers to be more conscious of the environment and the things or people they surround themselves with. But I also believe that learning to be conscious within your own being is an important stepping stone. Learning to really see what's in front of you is how our eyes become open to what the environment is doing, and becoming rooted in the moment is how we make progress. We've only really just begun diving into this territory in the magazine, but consider this conversation with Susanna a first step of sorts. In this episode, Susanna shares the wisdom behind her methods and some advice on how to use photography in particular to learn how to live in the moment and to see, really see, the beauty and inspiration that's in front of you. We live in a world where we operate almost on autopilot, and tragically, I fear that we become blind to the wonders of this world. Even if things can sometimes be ugly, we can learn to see them as beautiful. Susanna's own path of discovery began a decade ago, when the man she loved died suddenly of a heart attack. 13 months into her bereavement, she started writing a blog called Ink on My Fingers. She had no idea that this small step back out into the world would end up changing her entire life. In her words, "Blogging helped to reopen the door to my creativity, connecting me to other souls around the world as I shared my heart and found my way back to what was meaningful for me." What follows is her story, with a particular focus on how photography has become her meditation, and she shares how you can do this too. So let's go to the interview. Here's Susanna. Your journey took a very dramatic path. You know, I had hoped that you could set the stage for listeners by sharing some of that journey of what happened to you and how you came to begin to emerge from it on the other side, culminating with what you do now.
Okay. Well, 10 years ago, my partner died of a heart attack, and we didn't know he was ill. It happened very suddenly, and obviously I was thrown into this completely different world that I wasn't expecting to be in. And I moved out of the city where I was living, and the first year was very difficult. The first year was very hard. But it was as I came into the second year that I discovered blogging. And I had been working with a therapist. I'd been journaling, as I had always done all through my life, and doing all these different things to heal myself. But I had this kind of epiphany when I discovered the world of blogging. And this was back in 2006, so it feels like kind of dinosaur years for where things are now. But I found some blogs. I was reading them. I kind of connected with some of the bloggers just very naturally and organically, just kind of like making friends, really. And one of them in particular encouraged me to start my own blog. So I did in April 2006, and just started sharing a bit about what was happening for me, really. And it was a really lovely way to kind of get back out into the world from the comfort and safety of my living room. And I'd already previously worked as a journalist, and, you know, I had a degree in photography. So those sort of creative things I'd always been doing. But to suddenly find this place where you could publish things online and also build community around it was really transformational for me. So for the first few years, I was just sharing my story, sharing little pieces of the grief, but also it was much more about what I was learning now and dipping back into poetry, getting back into photography, kind of lots of creative things that were helping me to heal. And then it was 2008, I moved to a different town. And I kind of felt ready to move on and be in a different space and just kind of stretch my wings a little bit. And I was asked to teach a photography class at an adult education centre nearby, because by that point, I was doing some kind of portrait photography work. But they already had a class that was your kind of traditional photography, f-stops and aperture and, you know, the technical side. So I created something that was a bit more creative, and it was based on the healing journey that I'd been on the last few years. And I called it Unraveling, and 10 women signed up, which was the limit for the class. And we went on this 10-week, I think it was, journey together every week, taking pictures and sharing them. And I was setting them prompts, and we did this work together. And it was really quite transformational. And at the same time, I blogged about the evening class. And by then I had a little bit of an audience, and people were saying, you know, well, this sounds great, but, you know, I'm not in England. I can't come to the class. Could you do something online that we could do? And back then there weren't as many e-courses like there are now. The whole idea of teaching online or do anything like that was still really quite new. So I had to kind of figure out how to do it. It took me a few months to kind of get the balls to do it, because it felt quite audacious to even put something out there. But by January 2009, I'd figured it out, and I made a little website, and I hung out my shingle, and I said, you know, if you want to sign up. And by the end of the week, I had 100 women signed up. And that really was the beginning for me, and it was the beginning of my path of teaching, of really sort of being grounded in all the creative work that I'd been doing. Suddenly all my background in journalism and photography kind of came together with this incredible new stuff online. And that was how I created a little business, which I had no idea I was building. It just kind of happened. But obviously I'd been blogging for 3 years up until that point, and that's been the foundation for everything that's come since. So yeah, it was a really organic process. And one that I wasn't expecting, but it's been transformational for me, not just kind of business-wise and career-wise, but healing-wise. It helped me through my bereavement in ways I never expected.
It's so interesting the way that, you know, that the way that life just throws you such these, you know, these curveballs. And, you know, first of all, I'm very sorry for your loss. I mean, it's coming up on, well, it's a decade now that's, time passes so slowly and so quickly, but so slowly at the same time. But I mean, I love hearing about your journey, and I love how it just led to this unfurling into what you do now. But I wanted to sort of ask you, when it comes to blogging, you were writing about things that were really personal. And I was wondering, how did you get comfortable with sharing so much of yourself? I mean, when you first began to write, it was mostly for you, but then at some point you started to realize you were speaking to a larger community. And so that's a bit of a, you know, it's like, it can be a funny experience.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, the thing is, I've always written in a journal. I started journaling, or keeping a diary, as I called it, when I was 11. So I've always had this practice of writing about what's happening to me in, you know, in some form. So I'm used to kind of sharing in that way. Then as I worked as a journalist, I did a lot of first person pieces about stuff that was happening in my world. So I also had the experience of that. But then when I started blogging, I had such a small audience to begin with. And I kind of knew most of my readers, because back then it was very intensely personal, and someone would leave a comment and I'd leave a comment on their blog, and you get to know each other in your email, and, you know, the community was really small. So that gave me the opportunity to kind of practice sharing quite openly without thinking, God, everyone's reading this. You know, I mean, that didn't even occur to me. It just felt like me having a chat around the table with some people. It didn't feel like everyone's watching. So as the years passed and my audience grew, I was already in that comfortable space. And I mean, to be honest, I think a lot of it is just my personality. I'm very comfortable sharing things. You know, if I met you in person, I'd probably tell you all my secrets. I'm just like that. And I'm an introvert energetically. So I don't, you know, I don't spend a lot of time around loads of people, and I like my alone time, and I function best that way. But I'm very confident with it, and I'm happy to kind of share stuff. Because I just always have done it. It doesn't bother me that much. Having said that, though, I don't share everything, obviously.
Right, of course.
And even when I was talking about the grief, I never shared my partner's name. I've never shared a photo of us together. You know, there are some things that you want to keep private because they're just for me, and that's really important as well. So I think it's good to know kind of where your boundaries are, and what you do feel comfortable sharing, knowing that, if not immediately, maybe eventually, other people will be reading. And even though blogging, back then it felt very cozy, and it still can sometimes today, you're still putting it online. And the minute something goes online, it's there for the public if anyone finds it. So you know, you obviously have to keep that in mind when you pop something online on the internet. It's there for everybody.
I mean, that's interesting that you call yourself an introvert. And, you know, I'm similar to you in that way, where I enjoy my personal space, but then at the same time, there's this comfort in sharing and in community, which is, I think, it's a lovely way of being.
Well, I think being an introvert online is awesome because you don't have to be around lots of people, but you can still interact with loads of people. You know, it's perfect. Mm-hmm. If I had to do all of this in person all the time, I'd just be so tired. And actually, it took me a really long time to realise that I was an introvert. I mean, obviously, everyone talks about it these days, introvert, extrovert. You know, it's like talking about authenticity or vulnerability, or, you know, we've all got this language for it now. But, I mean, in days gone by, when I was at school, I had no idea that was the reason why I preferred to be in the art room painting on my own rather than out playing netball with all the girls in my class because they were doing my head in. So, you know, I never really understood how I worked. It's only, you know, as I've got older and suddenly there's language for it, you're like, I'm an introvert. It doesn't mean that I'm particularly shy, although some are, but it just means that I do get very tired when I'm around a lot of people for any length of time, and I'm kind of honoring and understanding that I just need a lot of downtime and time to recharge, you know, on my own. So yeah, it's been really helpful just to understand that makes everything else so much easier. Because then you think, oh, right, okay, well, if I do teach at a retreat for a week, which I have done, I'm going to need the next couple of weeks afterwards pretty much on my own because I'm going to need to, you know, recharge my battery. So it helps you kind of organize your time better, definitely.
Right, of course. I mean, that self-awareness is really key.
Yeah.
So I wanted to do just a little bit more stage setting because, you know, and talk about the word mindfulness, because lately, I mean, it's really bubbled to the surface and become a prominent idea, including in my own works. I mean, for me, it's an idea that comes with maturity or something similar, you know, the sense that knowing that all things will pass, that experiences in life come to an end, and that in order to truly be fulfilled, we must learn to nurture awareness and comfort in just being. So in my life, in all truthfulness, this is just something that I'm learning to do now. It's hard, but anyway, I was hoping that you could share your own version of what mindfulness means to you so that we can use it like as a touchstone of sorts throughout the interview.
Okay. Oh, gosh, that's quite a big question. I've never really thought about it quite so specifically. well, I mean, I've always said photography was like meditation for me because it makes me stop. When I take pictures, I stop. I look at only what's in front of me. I look through a viewfinder, which kind of narrows down my focus. I usually hold my breath for the moment when I'm focusing, and then I take the picture. So, I mean, that's always been throughout my whole life. That was the way I was mindful. It was taking pictures. But now it's kind of bled into everything else. For me, it's just being very aware of the present moment. You know, it's a classic Eckhart Tolle power of now thing. Because all we have is right now, is this moment right now. And I can fret about the past and I can kind of future trip on what might happen. But all we have is right now. And life is just a series of right nows all joined up together. So I have quite a busy mind. And there's a lot of chaos and noise in there. And so when I focus in on just what's happening right now, I feel so much calmer. So my way of mindfulness is just kind of appreciating what's happening in the now. And it could be, you know, making a coffee, but just doing it really quite thoughtfully, trying not to rush, taking pictures definitely, or, you know, purposefully turning off the computer and picking up a book rather than just having noise around me. I just try and slow things down as much as I can, but also knowing that when things are hectic and I've got to do stuff and I've got a deadline or I've got to be somewhere, I try and give myself enough space to kind of inhabit that craziness, if that makes sense. Knowing that, okay, well, this is going to be hectic, so, all right, let's just breathe and just do one thing and then the next thing and the next thing, and just trying to be a little calmer. The thing I always want to feel, no matter what I'm doing or where I am or who I am, is I just want to feel calm. That's kind of been the word that's been with me for so long. I just want to feel calm. And so when I'm being mindful and just bringing a bit of awareness and appreciating what's around me, I feel calm. So mindfulness for me is a way into being calm. I think that's probably the best way I can put it. I want to be calm. And usually that just means just slowing down and breathing, remembering to breathe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. Mindfulness is a way to calmness is, that's actually exactly how I have learned to use it, utilize it in my daily life too. It just helps compartmentalize things so that you're not looking at things as a whole anymore, which feels, you know, insurmountable.
Yeah.
It just allows you to sort of break things down.
Well, simplifying, isn't it? It's looking at your to-do list and thinking, shit, I've got so much to do that all of these things, and suddenly everything's pressing up against you. And it's like, well, actually, if I just break this down and simplify, let's just do the number one thing on my list. That's it today. And I kind of, yeah. And whenever I do that, and that's how I tackle my list. And I just think, okay, one main thing per day. That's it. Because if I try and do everything, I'm not going to be able to do it. It's like every time I have to create a new course, when I've written a book, you know, I can't do the whole thing all at once. So when I have the awareness of the whole thing, I feel flattened on the floor and the absolute opposite of calm. So I always try and break it down and simplify and think, okay, well, what's the one thing? And that immediately just makes my heart slow down a bit and I just feel calmer. And obviously now I know how to use things like meditation and obviously always journaling and just ways to help me, calm down and just feel a bit less stressed. There's always stress going on, but I've found ways to de-stress that are really helpful. And journaling and meditation have been definitely the biggest parts of that for me.
So it's so true. And I'm curious to know more about your meditation. But before I get into that a little bit, I wanted to know, I came across a phrase on your website that where you write that you know from firsthand experience that creativity and mindfulness are incredible tools for personal empowerment and healing. And that's sort of why I wanted to get into mindfulness a little bit, because I was curious why or how the two are related for you and why those two things together are so important in your world.
Well, the creativity bit is because I've always done that. You know, it's like the image I gave earlier of the girl in the art room escaping everyone else. That is kind of the essence of me, now I think about it. That's who I truly am. I've always done creative things, whether it was doing collage or painting or, you know, later on it was photography and studying it. And it's just how I function the best. And then when I'm doing those creative things, I get really absorbed in them, which is why then photography becomes like meditation. So for me, just personally, and I know a lot of people do this similarly, the creativity is a way into mindfulness because you become absorbed in what you're doing and time kind of becomes meaningless because you're just in the moment doing what you're doing, hopefully doing what you're enjoying. And that's incredibly powerful. And in my healing journey, I mean, creativity was one of the biggest, most important things I did. It started with the photography, it carried on with the journaling, and then the other piece for me was also therapy, working with the therapist and talking through everything that had happened. But therapy alone probably wouldn't have been enough. It's because I had the journaling, where I was, you know, writing everything out constantly, and then taking photographs every day and going outside and being back in the moment, which was this amazing relief from having to be so caught up in the bereavement. I was able to just kind of be outside, and I did a lot of artist dates inspired by Julia Cameron's book, The Artist's Way. And each week I'd go out on a date just with myself to take photographs somewhere new. And it was this hugely empowering thing to do because I'd be somewhere different, which was quite a brave thing for me at the time, because all I wanted to do was be at home and, you know, and kind of wallow in how I was feeling. So I'd go somewhere new and then I'd have my camera with me. And then it became this incredibly joyful thing of walking around and seeing new things and taking pictures and just getting so caught up in it. It was, you know, my first moments of feeling happy again after, you know, something so awful had happened. And that was all down to my lust for creativity. And then I'd come home and, you know, edit the pictures and put them on my blog. And God, it helped so much. And it was the act of sort of stepping out of myself and into the moment of where I was and just enjoying it and taking pictures, which I adore anyway. I mean, I love that Instagram's so popular now because everyone's taking photos. I think it's brilliant. But yeah, so creativity and mindfulness will always be connected for me, I think. I mean, that's just how my brain works. And I know a lot of other people feel that too. I think sometimes, you know, you want to be mindful, but it can feel a bit like, yeah, but what do I do to be mindful? And, you know, we're a species that wants to be doing. And a lot of mindfulness kind of feels like it's doing nothing. And that feels quite hard when we're so used to doing and achieving and deadlines and to-dos and appointments. And it's all very hectic. So if you've got something to do with a bit of mindfulness, I think that's an easier way to kind of access the peace and calm that can come from the, you know, the act of trying to be mindful. So if it's doing something creative, I think that's a really helpful way to tune into that. What's your experience of mindfulness?
Oh, you know, I mean, for me, well, first of all, I love what you said about how, you know, when you're doing something creative or something that you love, you often become so absorbed in it, it becomes like a meditation. And it's very true. I've noticed recently I've gone back to practicing yoga, and I realized at the end of it, after an hour and a half, that I had almost no thoughts. And it, you know, it's rejuvenating because of that, because I was just so absorbed in what I was doing. And that was really helpful. And so I can totally see how, you know, you get lost in a painting or you get lost in taking photographs as you do. But for me, I think mindfulness was really reinforced when I became a mother, because I have a little girl, she's two. And, you know, I just really realized how with each passing day that my child was changing and she was moving ever so slightly further away from me and the closeness that we shared in the womb. And it just made me realize how critical it is to live in each moment because it's transient. And, you know, that's where the concept really, it sort of startled me. And so now I just try and take that approach with more things, just realizing that, you know, these experiences are something to be learned from each one, and that it's going to, it passes before you blink an eye if you're not aware of it.
Absolutely. So, well, that's the amazing thing about kids. I mean, they really bring you back to the present moment because they're living in the now, you know, with every single breath. I mean, I don't have children, but I have a nephew who'll be turning 5 next month, amazingly. I don't know where the time's gone.
Yeah.
But he lives absolutely in the now. You know, I mean, he still hasn't got his head around the concept of time. I mean, he's getting better. We do the whole, you know, I'll see you in 5 sleeps, and he's understanding what that means. And, you know, but he still talks about last week and next week and doesn't really understand what it means. But that's amazing to me because it means that he lives right now. And when I, you know, if I talk to him on Skype, if I can't go down there at the weekend and we'll talk on Skype, and he's like, I miss you, and he wants to see me, and he just wants to play right now. You know, there's no kind of, oh, but Susie, I know you have to work and da 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 da. It's like, no, let's do it now. And he's just so mate. Well, I love him so much, my God. But he reminds me to be here and now and be present. And when I'm with him, obviously, I mean, I only get to see him every few weeks, so I try and squeeze as much, you know, much joy out of the time we're together as I can. So there's no looking on my phone. You know, my laptop's completely ignored because I just want to be present with him. And it's a reminder for me as a self-employed person to put work aside and just inhabit the now, because I want to be there with him. And it's a great reminder. And even though stuff needs to get done, I'd much rather just be, you know, be with him and be there. So, yeah, they're a gift. I mean, well, obviously, in so many ways, but mm-hmm. the reminder of time from kids is just, yeah, brilliant. It's beautiful.
Yeah. It truly is. I mean, with Charlie, she's in my life every day, and so it's easy for that to start to feel normal.
Yeah.
You know, and then the temptation, because like you being self-employed, and it's just you're juggling so much, and so you, the tendency to multitask is so strong, and you do realize that, oh, I checked my phone like 5 times in the last hour, and I answered emails, and I did all of this, and Charlie's here with me.
Yeah.
You know, it, and so it is. I mean, that's, you know, and then of course you reflect on that later, and you feel bad about it. So,
oh God, I can imagine the guilt. Yeah, must be horrendous. But equally, you still have things to do. So it's like I've thought about this, believe me, a lot. You know, I still hope that I will become a mother one day, and I wonder how I'm going to juggle all of that, because it's so easy for me to say, oh, you know, I'm present with no. Well, of course I am, because I'm only there for 3 days. But if it was every day and with my own child, yeah, I wonder how that's going to go. And I think about it now, because I have my lifestyle now where I'm self-employed, but I'm, you know, I'm single and I live alone. So I have tons of time to do stuff. But how will it be when actually my time has to be split more carefully because I'm looking after someone else? So, yeah, it's something I think about now, because, you know, I don't know how you guys do it, and it's something I'd want to do as well as I can without having guilt all the time. But who knows? You never know how it's going to go.
Oh, you don't. Mm. No, every minute is an opportunity to learn. I think that's the key.
Yeah.
It's just to realize that, you know what, I don't know it all, and I have to be flexible in my expectations. Yeah. That was a big lesson, too.
Yeah. We feel guilt because we care. You know, that's mm-hmm. the thing, and that's the bad thing. You know, we can.
Exactly. I wanted to go back to your photography a little bit, because that is a part of what you do. Well, it's a huge part of what you do, and it also interests me quite a lot. So the way that you talk about it and that you use it. So you sort of mentioned really in what you were talking about earlier that it became life raft of sorts for you, and it was this tool that you used to bring yourself back to the present. So what it sounds like photography has a role for you on an everyday basis. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that I thought about as I was sort of reading through your material and thinking about it was that you have a talent with the camera. And in our world, well, maybe this is just me, but I find that in our world, it's hard to do something without attempting to master it. So how do you work with your students who aren't trained photographers or who may not have like a quote unquote eye in order to keep their photography practice focused on what matters and the creative exploration that it's meant to be rather than producing good pictures?
Interesting question. I'm actually running my photo meditations course at the moment, and in the course I don't really talk about anything technical at all. I talk about some of the compositional ideas, and I give them kind of some of the basics, but also encourage them to break the rules. So, you know, we talk about the rule of thirds and, you know, negative space and all of that kind of stuff. I touch on a bit of post-processing. But what I'm really trying to encourage them is just to enjoy the process of looking. And actually, when I look at their photographs, we have a private Flickr group where everyone shares their pictures. There's no critiquing going on. Because, I mean, to my mind, every photograph is beautiful, just as I think every camera is beautiful. There's no hierarchy of, oh, well, that camera's better than this camera. I don't believe in that at all. Different cameras are tools for different purposes, but, I mean, that's as far as it goes, as far as I'm concerned. What I'm trying to encourage in them is to get out of the house, or even to be in the house, and look at what's in front of them. And then hopefully the next layer of that is to appreciate how the light's coming in the window, What colours are around? Did they notice complementary colours? Suddenly in the scene they're looking at, are they looking at some of the details? We talk about how to create their own style a little bit, which isn't something you can kind of consciously sit down and figure out. I mean, it will develop over time, but you can look back over your images and see, you know, there are themes appearing, and you know, you might have you might always take pictures of your feet, which is something I do, and you know, you'll have those themes appearing and you're like, oh, that's the beginning of a style. So what I try and do is just encourage them to open their eyes and look. And the problem with the online world at the moment, and obviously going forward, I don't imagine it's going to change. It's all about appearances now. You know, I mean, Instagram and all the different places where we're sharing pictures, it's kind of, we're living in such a visual time. And there's the, you know, you kind of want to keep up with the Joneses and share good pictures. But I mean, I don't even know what a good picture is anymore. If I look at the feeds that I follow on Instagram or on Pinterest or what have you, some of them are very inspiring, kind of aspirational images. Some of them are beautiful landscapes. Some of them are friends that are just living their lives and I want to see what they're up to. And all of those pictures are kind of equal in value to me because they're just sharing different things. And I'd never discount someone because she didn't take a good picture. I just don't believe in that. I want to know why you took the picture and what it means to you. And actually, photography is one of the few artistic endeavours that's actually got quite a level playing field. You know, we can all pick up a camera and take a picture, but not all of us want to pick up paintbrushes or, you know, want to pen a poem. But a camera, I mean, we have them on our phones now. I mean, we're living in the future. So I don't know, I just love pictures. I want to see a picture my mum's taken as well as some, you know, bigwig photographer. I'm interested in all of them, because they are communicating something about you and where you're at, what you're up to, what's meaningful to you. And that's the important bit, actually. I mean, I still, the pictures I share on Instagram, I'm obviously still going to put a bit of thought behind them because that's what I do. I'm a photographer. So I rarely share a really crappy picture to my mind just because that's how my eye works. You know, there's no kind of ulterior motive other than I like sharing pictures that I'm pleased with. But I have no judgment about other people's pictures. I mean, I really don't, because I want to know why they took it. And it thrills me when I run the photography class to see their eye developing and becoming more confident. I mean, one of the classic ones is just having the confidence to go out into the world and take pictures because you feel like an idiot. You're standing in front of this kind of dilapidated wall, and it's got really interesting texture, and you're taking a picture. And it's so easy to feel self-conscious because you feel like everyone's looking at you and thinking, what the hell is she doing? But actually, that's part of the joy of it for me. So I'm like, yeah, but you may think I look strange doing this, but I'm having a great time. Thanks very much. So, you know, part of the course is actually encouraging people to get out there and just enjoy and be brave about taking pictures. I mean, it's a whole other level when you start taking portraits of people. Asking a stranger to take a picture of them. You know, we just start with taking pictures in the city or the town where you live. One of my best bits of advice is actually just go where all the tourists go, because then you'll just fit right in, you know, and that's a really good way of practicing, you know, taking pictures when you're out and about, because most of the time, if we are playing tourists somewhere, you don't feel quite so self-conscious, but for some reason when it's the place where you live, you feel like you stand out a bit more. So good practice, go where the tourists are. That's good place.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's very true. You know, for me it was less the idea, my question I guess was less about the idea of critiquing. It's more about the internal dialogue that you have with yourself when, you know, for example, one of my favorite things to do is walk in the woods, and I find that environment just so exhilarating, and I'm overwhelmed by the beauty of the forest. Except that when I go to try and take pictures of it, I'm always disappointed because what my eyes see is not what my camera, what I made my camera see.
Yeah.
You know, and so then like that transformative process is lost a little for me anyway, when I feel like I can't get the results to translate what I saw in the first place. So it's just a,
Well, we could psychoanalyze that, couldn't we? I mean, that's...
Yeah, of course we could.
That's your expectation and what you're trying to achieve. Yeah. And then, oh, it's a bit of a failure. And, you know, there's a whole little rabbit hole we could go down there. But yeah, I mean, the thing is with photography, yeah, there are tips and tricks you can learn to figure out, oh, well, maybe different exposure was needed. Maybe I didn't need a different perspective. What camera am I using? You know, there are tips and tricks for sure. If, you know, if someone's trying to create a certain type of image. And there's also just a natural ability. You know, I mean, I can't paint to save my life. I mean, I did some painting at art school and, you know, it wasn't my natural ability. It just wasn't. I was just better at taking pictures. And if I tried to make a painting, I'd want it to look a certain way. And I've tried before. I mean, I did, this is a classic, a few years ago, I went to Italy on a retreat and I took a painting class with Flora Boli, who I love. I love Flora. And I was really excited to take her class. And I was just rubbish. I was absolutely rubbish. I cannot paint. We were doing these huge canvases and trying all these different techniques. And my point was I just wanted to paint like Flora, classic, like I'm sure most of her students want to. And everyone else seemed to be doing it. And I just couldn't seem to get it together. It just looked like a big splodge on the canvas. And I just couldn't paint. And it was so frustrating. But then by the time I got to the end of the week, it was the most liberating few days I'd ever had, because I just thought, wow, I don't have to try and be a painter here. I don't have to be good at this. And it's okay. And it was so liberating. It was brilliant. So, I mean, sometimes there are creative things we try and do. We can just be shit at. And that's it. And that's okay. You know, we don't have to be brilliant at everything. And actually, it's nice to then sort of hone in on the things we are good at or that we enjoy, that we have a natural kind of aptitude for. But yeah, I mean, if you want to take pictures of the trees, you want it to look a certain way, it doesn't look a certain way. I don't know. I think there's a point where you have to kind of surrender, and perhaps the lesson there is just enjoy being present in the trees, you know, yeah. Or take some pictures and just have them be for you as a memory of where you were. You know, I think we're also living in a time where everything needs to be shared immediately and look where I am, click, send the picture. And actually there's so much to be said for just having these personal moments and not sharing. I mean, I've got a picture I took when I was in New York a few years ago, and it's not the best picture I've ever taken, far from it. But actually the energy that's in the picture, it reminds me of the moment when I was standing on that street and had a little personal epiphany that I had. And so I still look at that picture and go, oh, yeah, and I'm taken straight back there. But I don't need to share it with anyone because it's not the best picture. And that's me just judging it. But it's, you know, visually it's not the best. But it's what it means for me is the important bit. And that makes it absolutely priceless. And it's one of my favourite pictures. So, you know, there you go. It depends what you're trying to achieve, really.
Yeah, of course. And it goes back to what we were talking about before about sort of resetting your expectations and also the discovery in the exploration of it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to keep going with photography for just a moment longer because, you know, so you teach that for you, as you said before, photography is a meditation and that you work to create images infused with soul that carry an imprint of your heart. So this sounds like a beautiful practice and an effective tool to focus your attention on what's in front of you, like you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered if you could dig into what this actually means for people that aren't familiar with your work. So for me, the juxtaposition of an internal process, like finding your heart or your soul, and then projecting it through something external, like a photograph, is really very interesting. So could you sort of explain that concept a little?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing where you're talking about the trees and you want it to look a certain way. So if you came through the class with me, we'd talk about perspective and, you know, the tips and tricks that I was talking about.
Because
a lot of the times how you're feeling in the moment can be translated into the picture, but sometimes you need a little bit of extra help with it. In the class, I try and get everyone to think about what they're trying to achieve and how they can do that. What would be, the way to achieve that? So it could be that maybe you're looking for something a little bit more abstract, or maybe you're looking for it. Maybe the picture needs to be in black and white, for example. So it's kind of creating different layers of feeling in your images by thinking about what you're focusing on, taking elements out of what you're seeing in the viewfinder, maybe using a coloured filter to create a bit more of the feeling that you're trying to achieve. So in that way, it's almost like making photographs that are a bit like painting, because you're layering in little bits of meaning in the colour and what you're focusing on and the perspective and maybe the blurred background, or choosing everything to be in focus, or whatever it is like that. So the class is kind of a combination of mindfully going out and taking pictures and being in the moment, but also being really thoughtful about what you're seeing. Because, you know, I know a lot of us, you go out, you just point the camera and you shoot, the point and shoot thing. And actually, in photo meditations, or in the way I take pictures, it's about stopping, slowing down, taking a breath, and then looking again at what you're seeing, and really looking, and kind of honing in. I mean, it's amazing that you obviously have this viewfinder, so you're looking through this kind of square or rectangular frame and actually being conscious of what is filling that frame in every corner, not just what's in the middle, but what's on the side. What are you going to choose to put in that frame? What are you going to choose to leave out? Do you need to get closer? Do you need to get further back? You know, it's putting thoughtfulness, I suppose is the better word, thoughtfulness into how you take the picture, not just, snapping. But putting some thought into it. And as you put thought into it, you're layering yourself into it. Because even if you look at a picture of a landscape and there are no people there, the one person that's there is the photographer who's looking. And you're then translating that experience for the person who's looking at the picture, for the viewer. So we're always layering ourselves into our pictures. You know, it's like if you take a self-portrait, you still choose which one is the one, or which one you share. And in that picture, you're kind of seeing something in yourself that you want to project back out to whoever's going to look at the picture. So really, it's just, yeah, it's different layers of thoughtfulness that go into the creation of the image. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I'm daydreaming as you're talking.
I know, we need to go out with cameras and go and take pictures. I mean, this is the main reason why I've always loved film photography, because the awesome thing about that is if you had a 35mm film camera, you put a proper roll of film in there, you have 36 shots and that's it. So in those 36 shots, you have to think really carefully about what each of those pictures is going to be. You can't just snap off 300 pictures. Pictures like you can with digital now. And because I was actually lucky enough to go to college at the beginning of the 90s, when I was at art college, we didn't have digital cameras back then. So all of the photography I did was on film. And I was a student. I had limited funds. I could only buy a certain amount of film each week. So you had to really put some thought into it. And then I'd, print them out as a contact sheet, and I'm poring over it, deciding which images I liked enough to, enlarge into photographs. And there was mindfulness back then, especially, but I didn't obviously realise it at the time, which is why when I got back into photography, a few years back, I also fell back in love with film photography. And I was shooting a lot with my Holga, using toy cameras, or using my Hasselblad, and also doing a lot with Polaroids, because they were just like the epitome of mindful photography. You have one shot, this one piece of Polaroid film, and you are going to spend your time getting the focus right, deciding what's in the shot or not in the shot. What's the light doing? Does this feel right? Oh, I don't want to waste this. This one photograph is costing me £2 or $2 or whatever. So I don't want to mess it up. And so you put all of that thought in, and every part of it is considered. And and it's this creation just for this one picture. And who does that these days with a digital shot? You don't. You snap away. You think, oh, well, I'll edit it out later. I'll crop it out later. And so that's why film photography is a brilliant way to learn about mindful photography, because you have to slow down. And it's like with anything, slowing down brings more thoughtfulness, and you come back into the moment. You're not racing ahead. You're slowing down. And that can only be a good thing, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I love that. What happens to the images after they're taken? So I know this is about the process, but so much of taking photographs is about the end result. So how do the two align in this case?
In what way? What do you mean? With film photography, digital photography, or what?
Well,
do you mean?
With both. I mean, with both, because I think that, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but in what you teach, it just sort of seems like so much of it is about being in the moment of taking that photograph and considering it, like you were just talking about.
Yeah.
But then you have a product. And so is it more about the process, or is the product equally important?
It really depends how you are and what you're mm-hmm. trying to do and what you enjoy, actually. Some people mm-hmm. really enjoy tinkering with their photos after they've taken them. You know, there are lots of textures you can buy, Photoshop actions, and clever things you can do in Lightroom. And actually, that's like a creative art form in itself, editing your photographs.
Yeah.
You know, and people do amazing things. Mm-hmm. And for a while, you know, I was adding textures and, you know, different washes of color. And you're like, wow, this is magical. Look what I can do. And it's really fun. It's a really fun thing. Even my mum is a whiz at Photoshop these days. So, I mean, it's a fun and creative thing to do. It's great. These days, my photos are very lightly edited these days. What I normally do, if it's an iPhone picture, which shockingly the majority of my pictures are, because my iPhone, I have to say, has got a pretty nifty little camera in it these days, I use the Visco app to edit my pictures. And all I do is up the exposure a little bit if they feel too dark. I might boost the contrast a little bit, and I use one of the filters, but then I dial it down, so it's only lightly altering the, you know, the saturation or the color of the picture. I like my pictures nowadays to kind of just look like they came out the camera, mm-hmm. you know, but with a little bit of enhancing. But that's just to make the most of the picture itself. And actually, that's what I did in the darkroom all those years ago. You know, I'd adjust the color to make sure it looked good. If it was a black and white picture, I'd do a bit of dodging and shading to make the best of it, you know, make the most of what the raw material I have. If it's film photographs, I just scan them and that's it. With Polaroids, I scan them and obviously correct the color to get them as close to the original as possible. But that's it, really. I mean, they don't really need anything else. The fact that they are film kind of gives them a softness, which is lovely anyway, so I don't really need to do anything to them. So it really depends what you're after. If you want to make a really incredible textured artistic creation, great, you know, then you've got these raw materials that you can use. Personally, I prefer things to just look a bit more pure, I suppose, a bit more, you know, as they are in the real world. But that's just my personal preference. That's just, I like the simplicity these days. You know, I've had my years of textures and actions, and actually now I just like things to be quite simple. That just is more pleasing to my eye, but who knows how that will change in the years. I don't know.
I have a question that's a bit more philosophical perhaps, but I'm interested in your answer. So do you think that creativity has to be released from perfectionism in order to be healing?
Do I think that creativity has to be released from perfectionism? Well, I think I don't understand how you could be perfect in creativity anyway, to be honest. The whole point of being creative is that you kind of make a mess, whether you're, you know, painting or gardening or taking pictures or writing, or it's always going to be a bit messy because out of creation comes new things, and that's a messy process in itself. But as for creativity connected to healing, no, perfectionism doesn't really come into it at all for me. I just don't see it in there. If anything, healing, if we're talking about healing from bereavement or something that's happened, or just healing the past, it's always going to be a messy process, because wading back into what's happened is going to release a whole lot of feelings. And probably the majority aren't very comfortable to feel. It's going to get messy. So again, in creativity and in healing, there is messiness, and there's no room for perfectionism. So I don't even know if that's an answer. No, it's all about being messy and surrendering to that and letting yourself feel it.
Unraveling was your first course, and you did talk about it in your introduction very briefly. And I know you don't offer it anymore, but I feel as though it did lay the foundation for a lot of what you do. So I was hoping that you could explain the concept a little bit.
Yeah, no, it hugely laid the foundation for everything. I ran it 20 times in the end, and now I've retired it to make way for new things. Unraveling was all about taking photographs and journaling, basically, my two kind of healing things that I did in after my bereavement, or during my bereavement, I should say. So each week I'd set them a topic for the week that we'd be photographing, some aspect of their life. And then I'd also give them a couple of journaling exercises to work through as well. And then within the course each week, I would create a video talking them through that week's topic, giving them some ideas, sharing a bit of, you know, some of my stories. And we also had a space where we could share our pictures and talk. So it was like a kind of community aspect was quite important. But really, it was my way of getting people to look at their lives through their camera. So the topics included shooting your feet for a week, which is a way to notice where you were in the world and where you go, who you stand next to. We'd look at our reflections, we'd obviously look at our faces. We thought about our alter egos, we looked at the way we adorn ourselves, we looked at sacred places, we looked at the way we nourish ourselves, we looked at our memories, so looked at, you know, photographs from the past, we looked at the gifts that we bring to the world. So it was a quite a thorough way to look at different parts of your life, really, all within an 8-week course, which was sort of the longest I wanted to run it. And hopefully people got to the end wanting to continue and keep looking. And for a lot of the women over the years that I ran the course, it was the first time they'd really looked at their life in any kind of structured way. You know, a lot of the time they were kind of avoiding looking at things. And suddenly having this English woman say, right, go out and take pictures of your feet, was sometimes quite a challenge. But it opened the doorway to look at other parts of their world and kind of find some love and appreciation for it. That was the point, was to see what's there. I mean, especially in Face Week, when we took pictures of our face, it was a really beautiful way to kind of accept how we look, or begin to accept how we look, shall I say. And, you know, because the face that we have is all that we have. I mean, we can't change it. We can't suddenly look like someone else. We have, you know, the journey is to find a way to accept what is, and appreciate it, and know that the woman looking back at you in the mirror is your ally. So that was some of the work that we were doing in the course, and it was always really powerful, and I loved running it. But I've evolved as well, so it felt right to run the course one last time this year, and now I've retired it, so I can move on to kind of the next incarnation of it, really, which will bring, you know, more of what I now know. When I created the course, it was, you know, 6 years ago, and I've changed since then. So there's kind of more teaching I want to bring in. And also I'm older now, and I want to bring that in as well. So, yeah, that's what I'm working on this year, is my new course, a new website, you know, lots of new things that feel quite exciting. I think that's the thing about having like an online business, being an online entrepreneur, you can always evolve things and change things, and that's quite exciting. I'm not in one place. I can move and change as my life moves and changes. So that's what I keep trying to do.
Yeah, it's such a fun place to be.
Yeah,
the flexibility that comes with running a business online is just amazing.
Yeah,
but that course Unraveling sounds really, really gorgeous and a lovely experience. And I know that literally thousands of women took the course from you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah.
And yeah, for an online course, I mean, wow.
Well, I mean, there were 6 years, obviously. But
still.
The trick seems to be integrity and word of mouth. These days, there are an awful lot of courses out there that will teach you how to market your courses. There are now websites where that will host your courses. You know, there's a ton of stuff. There's WordPress plugins that will do it for you. When I started, none of that existed. So, I mean, I think I was reading Copyblogger a lot and just thinking, how the hell am I going to do this? it was still really early days. People were still getting quite upset about people monetizing their blog or having advertising. Whereas now it's just so normal. I mean, Flickr had only just I've been on Flickr for about a couple of years, but Facebook was still in its infancy. There was no Twitter, there was no Instagram. I mean, it was really early when I started blogging. So when I created Unraveling as a course, the question was, well, how do I translate it from an in-person evening class to an online experience? How the heck am I going to do that? How are we going to share our photos? How am I going to share the course content with them? Or how am I going to do this? You know, and I had to kind of figure it out bit by bit, which I did, and it worked very well. And each time I ran the course, I kind of refined it, improved it, learned what worked well, learned what worked less well, you know, and you're always learning. And also, I mean, when I first launched it, I didn't know it was going to be such a community project, which is what it turned out to be. So that became a much more important part of it each time I ran the course. Whereas now it's so easy to kind of put some stuff together and shove it out online and hope that people sign up. But in my experience, what really worked was obviously having a course that was good and people got something out of it. And, you know, there were other courses I ran that were less good and people got less out of it and I didn't run them again. You know, and it was a definite case of trial and error. But with Unraveling, people talked about it to their friends and their friends signed up. So word of mouth became hugely important. And you want to have good standing online. You know, people need to be able to trust you, but for reals, not because you've got a copywriter to write the right things on your about page, but because you're genuinely doing good stuff. I mean, that's really important. And, you know, in all these years of running the courses, I've only had like 3 people ask for their money back. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah,
you
that
know,
is.
After all those people, but it's because I would rather cut off my own arm than think that someone had a bad experience of something that I was doing. You know, and if someone honors me by giving me money in exchange for doing something that I've created, I want to make sure they have a really good time and that it's worth every penny and that they get something out of it. And just as if I sign up for a course, that's what I expect, you know. And I've taken courses in the past that completely didn't live up to what I was expecting. And I've taken other ones that were mind-blowing. So, you know, it's all about the integrity of the person doing it. And, of course, as it becomes more and more popular, you know, just as everyone and their dog wants to be a life coach, everyone and their dog is creating an e-course online because it's such a great way to make money. But actually, you need tons and tons and tons of integrity about what you do. And just as you can't just run an evening class, expect some people to turn up and give them, you know, just a couple of things to do and hope they make the best of it. It's the same when you're online. You know, and your credibility and the trust that people have in you, that's all you have really online. You know, you can hype it up all you like, but people need to be able to trust you. That's important.
Yeah.
Just as you would have in any offline dealings, you know, and there are always going to be the charlatans and the scam artists and all of that stuff online, of course, because it's so easy to slap up a website and, you know, put a buy now button on it. But your integrity and your reputation is, you know, is what you have. And especially in our kind of part of the internet where, you know, I'm working with women and, you know, I know a lot of them personally. I've met them on retreats. They are always welcome in my inbox. You know, I'm very accessible and that's important as well. I mean, maybe one day it'll get to the point where I really can't answer every email. But at the moment, I really do my best because, you know, I'm just a normal, regular person doing this stuff. So there's no kind of barrier that people have to try and get past. It's just, you know, I'm exactly like you and, you know, I'll share what I know. I'll be as helpful as I can. And that's how I kind of run my business, really. And it works and I love what I do. And if it's helpful, then I'm going to keep doing it because there's a lot of fulfillment for me. But, you know, if it wasn't helping other people, I probably wouldn't do it. I'd do something else because it's important to me. It means a lot. So, yeah, that's why I do it.
Yeah. Well, I love your approach and what you're doing. I mean, that's why I wanted to bring you on because I just find you so inspiring.
Thank you.
And so I'm heading up to my last couple of questions here for you. But one of the things that I wanted to ask is that, you know, as I said before, thousands of women have taken your course in order to learn from you and learn from each other. And I came across a quote as I was preparing for this that said, in learning we will teach, and in teaching we will learn. So I'm curious how that relates to you and your experiences in teaching.
Oh, God, it's 100% what it is. Yeah. I mean, the whole, you know, you teach what you need to learn. Absolutely, you do. I mean, you need to have a sort of grounding in understanding what you're teaching, obviously. But what I find is, I mean, I do only teach what I know. I'm not going to try and teach a class about accounting or something because I know nothing about it. But,
of course.
Yeah, but actually, in the process of putting the content together, you learn more. You read around your subject and you learn more than you did. So that's always fascinating and really exciting. But then also you learn from your students and your participants. You know, they're always going to bring something that you couldn't possibly have predicted. And that makes it richer as well. So, yeah, I mean, you need to have a kind of foundational understanding of what you're about to launch into teaching. But you mm-hmm. learn as you go. You learn more. But you learn from the people that are you know, learning from you. It's a kind of it's a mutual thing. It's lovely, actually. I really enjoy it. I love learning from, you know, the people that do me the honor of taking my classes. You know, it's fascinating and yeah, very rewarding.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So could you tell us about what classes you're offering now then? You said you have a new one this year.
Yes, I do, but I can't tell you what it's called yet. So,
oh, okay.
That's under wraps for now. So I'm working on a new website with a brand new designer, doing lots of new things and just looking at everything I'm doing and making sure I'm putting the clearest message out there. After so many years online, that's feeling like a really good thing to do. So the new course will be announced with the launching of the new website, which is hopefully happening in June. I will still be running all my other classes. So there are four. There's obviously photo meditations, which we've talked about. There's blogging from the heart, journal your life, and also the sacred alone, which is my meditation class. And then there'll also be my new sparkly, can't wait to launch it class that I'll be running. But then next year, next spring, I have my next book coming out, which is a photography book all about London, which I've spent the last 6 months photographing. So I've got that coming as well.
Oh,
and lots of other things lots of other plans. I mean, I had surgery at the beginning of the year, so I've had quite a few weeks of not being able to do a lot of work. And now I'm kind of on the other side of that. I'm raring to go and I've got all these ideas. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, all of that's happening and hopefully a meditation album and lots of things I want to do. I'm feeling quite creative and it will be messy and imperfect, but I'll enjoy the process. So yeah, that's what I'm working on.
That sounds amazing. And so everything will be staying at susannaconway.com.
Yes.
Right? Yeah,
that's my online home. Everything's there.
All right. So as my very last question to wrap up, I wanted to ask you, who would you say gravitates towards your teachings, and why would you suggest that the average person consider taking one of your courses?
Mm, good question as well. People are a bit like me, really. I've had girls as young as 18 and women as old as sort of mid-60s. So I kind of attract all ages, really. But the average age is probably sort of late 30s, early 40s, if I had an average. But really, the people that are drawn to my classes want to get to know themselves a bit better, and they want to do it in a creative way. They don't want to just be taught things. They want to also get involved with the doing of it. So like creating a blog, like writing in a journal, like taking pictures, like, you know, sitting in meditation. They want to be active in what they're doing. And I'm also teaching tools. So it's lovely to know how to maintain the journaling practice, you know, how to write authentically and from the heart on your blog, or to, you know, improve your photography. So it's kind of hobby based, if you like. But mm-hmm. yeah, anyone who's interested in creativity, really, but as a way to know themselves better, that's what it all comes down to in the end. Everything I teach is just about knowing yourself better, which can only ever be a good thing. You know, I think when we have an understanding of who we are, what's important, what we love, what we don't love, you know, what we contribute to the world, it just makes everything just so much easier, so much more enjoyable. So anyone who's curious about themselves and yearns for a bit of extra creativity in their world, they want to come and hang out with me, because that's what I'm all about.
Well, it sounds really, really fantastic. And yeah, I'm just looking online. I'm seeing that your next photo meditations course is in the summer in June. Yeah. Maybe you'll see me.
Yeah, come along. Come along.
I'd love to. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Susanna, for sharing all of that and sharing a little bit more about what you do. I loved learning about it, and I know our listeners will too, so I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been really fun.
So that concludes my talk with Susanna. I hope it inspired you, and I hope you'll share it with someone you know who might enjoy what Susanna had to say. Head on over to puregreenmag.com/podcast/Susanna for the show notes, and please tell us what you think of the podcast so far by sharing your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/puregreenmag or by leaving a review on iTunes, which is the best possible way to support the show. This podcast is created by Pure Green Magazine. Go to puregreenmag.com to subscribe and keep up with the great content we're sharing there. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.